Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is Joanne Robertson, the new President of Europe and Transatlantic Growth at BPI Group. Self-described as positivity personified and fueled by Glaswegian negotiating skills, her career has taken her from student politics at the University of Strathclyde to the PR jury at Cannes to leading one of the world's largest agency networks. Now, with BPI, she's leaning into her roots as a disruptor to build a transatlantic business bridge at a moment of intense global change. This is a story about resilience and why sometimes you need a bit of grit in the oyster to drive progress. Joanne, welcome to Changemakers. It's great to see you. If I was looking for a definition of you, it is the glass half full. Positivity personified.
Oh, thank great to you. See you. Great to see you too. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, brilliant to get you on your first few days in the new job, Bully Pulpit International, BPI. You've just written a really interesting post about what a bully pulpit moment is and what it means to you. Pick up the story.
And definitely. Well, look, when I was approached by Bully Pulpit, God, almost a year ago exactly, because I was in a global role, I had heard of them in the US, but I'd never really paid much attention. And I was enamoured by this thing. Like, what is this Bully Pulpit International? Now, my husband is obsessed with American politics.
Right.
So he gave me a quick, you know, summary rundown. But as
So what did he say? What's the one liner?
He said it was defined by Theodore Roosevelt that ideas are fine, but unless they have incredible communication, they don't drive progress. Mm. And I think that's absolutely
that's
right.
That's great. Yeah.
And look, as I got to know the BPI team in the US, Europe, the UK, I could see why it was such a perfect name because for the firm, but also for the industry, right? We are in a time where big ideas in every walk of life are needed.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I was just as you were speaking, I was thinking idealism is a word that I would very much associate with you. And not just as in the idea of it being idealistic, but the very fact that ideas matter.
They matter so much.
Right. So
they matter so much. In our industry, in the world, like it's funny. I grew up in like corporate comms, right?
Yeah.
And then I moved to Ketchum, which is a very brand agency. And so I was immediately immersed in the world of consumer brand communications where creative is like the heart and soul.
What's the lesson for corporates?
And I embraced it, right? Yeah. Because I was like, well, if I'm in this new world, I was still at the beginning doing corporate and public affairs. I then went on to do actually mostly consumer brand, but with a deep corporate sense. And for me, when you have people who are curious, both intellectually and culturally, who are not afraid to throw big, meaningful, purposeful ideas into the mix, and be able to bring a client on that journey, bring another human on that journey, that's game-changing for businesses, for people, for organisations. So as I come to Bully Pulpit International, the fact that that's embedded in so much of the firm already, and I think we can take it to a whole new level, was incredibly attractive because ideas matter more than ever.
Well, I suppose ideas matter, but you've also got to have the bravery to implement them. And I suppose the question of the brave advisor is a big one, right? In terms of a very febrile commercial environment, political environment, economic environment. I mean, speaking truth unto power is not for the faint-hearted.
No, and people are scared, right? If anyone's out there right now claiming that they're not frightened of what's happening in the world and in society, you know, they've definitely got their head in the sand. People are scared. And people are scared of change. They always have been. You look at all the psychology around it. It's rare to find people who embrace change.
We say we want it and then,
we
of course...
Don't really. We it's uncomfortable, right? It's really uncomfortable.
But it's in the heart of progress, of course.
Indeed. And I'm someone who does genuinely love change. I love a bit of grit in the oyster. Yeah. I love to have a debate. And I always say, you know, I grew up in a working class family on a council estate in Scotland. Yeah, first in my family to go to university, never knew anybody who was in this type of job.
How did that shape you?
Well, I don't see hierarchy.
Right.
And I was never taught middle class norms, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't part of growing up. Obviously, I started to then understand it because I went to a middle class school, still a state school, but out of my town. Mm. So I started, when I got to 11, 12, I started to realise...
But you see things from a lot of different angles.
I do, but also I'm never afraid. And I would say 80% of my career that has served me so incredibly right. well. There's been a 20% where people haven't liked it or enjoyed it.
Well, I mean, being married to a Glaswegian, I love that you've described yourself as having Glaswegian negotiating skills. I mean, I have some insights into what they might be, but I think that does speak to a certain element of toughness. It speaks to a certain element of no nonsense. And does it? What else does it speak
straight
to?
Straight talking. You know, no one ever has to guess where they are with me. Mm-hmm. I really believe, and it's that I would say that's the superpower I have with clients. You know, I don't try to make things sound more intellectually
than they are,
intelligent than they are, because often the answer is the obvious one, right? So I remember early in my career sitting in rooms where there were many people pontificating over mm-hmm. an issue. And then I would be the one
I've
who would say...
I've never been accused of pontificating.
I'm sure not. But I would be the one in the room who would say, sorry, like, isn't it just a cup?
But around the
room, like, what would happen is, like, clients would be like, yes, it is. And I think there's a lot of bravery in... a lot of self-awareness where you don't feel you have to over-intellectualise things.
Well, there's also a lot of smarts and simplicity, of course, indeed. As well. I mean, one of the things, though, I guess, is what a lot of people will say is that the advisory world is not brave enough in offering its opinion. It will often say, well, on the one hand, you could do this. On the other hand, you could do that. I mean, are we at an environment now where, in a world where there is so much, you know, sort of uncertainty, this stormy environment. I mean, do advisors need to have more lead in the pencil in their ability to give the point of view, give the advice, and ultimately stand by the advice?
And be held accountable for it, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, I've always felt that. And in a world that is more complex and more volatile than ever, it's not useful to a client. I mean, I read an analyst report of the recent Omnicom earnings. Having just come out of Omnicom, I'm still interested in what's happening there and the consolidation after the acquisition of IPG. And their chief technology officer basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially what he said was, with our tech stack, we will be able to give clients 50 different creative options and they can choose which one they
right.
want. And my immediate reaction was like, what client in their right mind wants that, right? The whole, and actually most clients could probably generate that themselves with the mm-hmm. fast-paced evolution of technology. And so I think that's playing the wrong game.
Well, they always want the navigator, don't they? They want somebody who can take the compass points and actually make some sense of what the chart is showing them.
And I think it's about, I always do think you have to be curious and well-read and interested enough in the world that you can see the different perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. So you cannot be narrow-minded in that your solution is the only solution, because that's mm-hmm. not true. For most issues that clients face, there are multiple options. But the point is, you briefly, I'm a big fan of brevity, you briefly outline what those options are, and then you stick your flag in the sand and say, and based on my experience, my knowledge of your company and what's happening in the world, this is my best advice to you.
Right. Now, you and I have been speaking this morning at a business event where I think I would sum it up by saying you had this macro pessimism about the world around us and this micro positivity of that might be the case, but we'll be all right because of whatever the local conditions might be. But that does speak to an environmental position in terms of how leaders feel about business at the moment. Talk to us about good communications in that environment, and I suppose how they contribute to the rise of the resilient corporation.
Oh, I love that phrase, the rise of the resilient corporation. Well, look, I think comms is a tool. It's not the starting point. And I think that's a mistake that many businesses make. They think communications is the answer, when actually the core decisions they make about their business mm-hmm. are the most important thing. And we go back to the word bravery. I think because people are fearful, because there's so much uncertainty. I mean, you go to bed and you don't know what you're going to wake up to the next morning, geopolitically, economically. And so leaders, and I say this politically and in business and in society, are become too passive. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, I'm going to move whatever way the wind has blown overnight. I want to be agile enough to move against it, which
is
fine.
What's behind that, do you think? Because, I mean, I suppose there has been a, you know, for most of our lifetimes, there's been a view where, you know, I suppose political environments are relatively benign. Because
well, they've been pretty stable.
They've been quite stable.
Well, you look back, I was joking with a friend of mine at the weekend where it was like, you think back, now I was kind of a young political activist at university when we were having the transition from like Bush to Clinton. And we thought they were like polar opposites.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, one was left and one was right. In fact, I mean, now I'm older, wiser, hopefully. I look back and I'm like, God, they were like two sides of the same coin, right? So there was differentiation. There was a different political philosophy, but it was a very stable transition, right? You now look at how we've moved from a Biden to a Trump, and it has been seismic for society and for business. So we can no longer rely on...
It might be more seismic again in the future.
Well, probably, right?
I mean, I suppose how you prepare for that, because I think every generation kind of reaches a point where they think they've got it sorted and they kind of understand the world. And then, of course, the world then changes again.
And our colleague Geeta Hari, this morning, I think, made a point that I make all the time to my own family, never mind clients, which is, my mum always said this to me growing up, don't worry about what you can't control, because that's time wasted. And I do think there are too many humans right now, what we cannot control this Trump administration and the decisions they make, for example, to go to war in Iran. Like, we have no control. But what we do have control over, what businesses have control over, is where they are taking their organization. And not enough of them have that North Star, that vision for, even if it's for 12 months. I mean, we used to talk about having a five-year strategy, right? But, and I still think that's relevant. I think if you have a business strategy for five years, you do need agility. You do have to adapt, but you don't have to change course. But and I, so for I, me, yeah. that's the core of it.
Well, that, and I think the agility point is really interesting. By the way, we should just say for listeners, Geeta Hari, former director of communications at Number 10. So he knows a thing
he
or
does.
Two about some of these issues, I guess. But I suppose one thing that comes to mind is that when I look at your career, Jan, I would say purpose leadership is an important part of it, in terms of the causes, the ideas that you have championed and made at the heart of your own leadership style. But quite a lot of those ideas are under pressure at the moment.
You know, fashion, you might say.
Well, environment, diversity, equity, and inclusion. That they were things that seemed to be increasingly mainstream. And now, as you say, there is a much bigger issue in terms of actually where they sit within business priorities. And I suppose your feeling about that as a naturally positive person. Mm. I mean, is that time to double down in the fight to make your case, or actually is it the importance is to reposition and rethink?
I think it's both, right? So I think I'm so hugely disappointed by many people who've just, you know, collapsed like a house of cards at the first sign that DEI in particular was out of fashion. And what that teaches us, certainly teaches me, is so much of what happened between 2020 and 2024-5 was performative, because it was in fashion. So it wasn't deep and meaningful. And that's, you know, I am an everly optimistic person. It's just disappointing. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of just makes me feel a bit sad that there was so much performative action in that area. The truth is, though, there isn't a person that I meet, and I'm, you know, I'm very politically connected across the spectrum in the UK, in Europe, in the US. There isn't a person I meet who privately won't say how important it is to continue that agenda.
Yeah.
I don't meet anybody who doesn't believe in climate change
and
the action we need to take. And so there's a piece for me about how do we as leaders in our own right, and then the access we have to very senior leaders in business and politics and society, how do we give them the confidence to make that case? Now, I think part of the problem is we've ended up, partly social media, partly polarization of politics, we've ended up in this position where you're either pro-environmental, you know, change and progressiveness, or you're anti-climate change. Mm. You're either someone who wants to see a diversification of the boardroom and more diverse voices around every business table, or that's woke and it's, you know, extremist. Yeah. There is a, most people are still in the middle ground, and the, you know, the centre and the middle ground is not a popular, again, it's out of fashion, but the majority of people are there. But how do we build their confidence?
Well, also language matters, right? Because, you know, if you, in a US context, if you use green, it's politically loaded. If you use clean, it's a completely different phrase in terms of actually what it suggests. Something though, just to go back on that you said there, which I think is at the heart of perhaps what the challenge is now, is that when you say that I've not met a person that disagrees with me, well, a lot of people will say, well, actually, this is the challenge that leaders have, is that they reinforce it off each other. How do you get lenses elsewhere in terms of, and actually, how do you reach out beyond the consensus to actually win the case, win hearts and minds, actually make it real?
But I think, look, when I say they don't disagree with me, they might disagree with me on the, like, what we should do about it, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, I think in professional political life, and actually just the people I know in, you know, my own personal life, there aren't that many, like, hardcore climate deniers.
Right.
Right? And now, there may be really varying views on how we should tackle climate change and the investment we should put in it. And being able to create environments that debate can happen without it being polarized, without it being personal. Because the big issues of the day, we can't seem to have a sensible conversation. We don't want to concede ground that...
Yeah. But I suppose the issue is, it's somewhere in the middle, isn't it?
Always.
So it's not about denying climate as much as, well, actually, would I rather address this issue as opposed to being wealthier, poorer, whatever, in terms of the decisions on the table.
Well, and that's the complexity. I think often we want to narrow down into the most simplest format. That's the complexity, because the fact is, as I believe it, and as all the data I've read on it, if we don't tackle climate change, all the other things that are important to us, healthcare systems, you know, the economy, et cetera, it's going to be fundamentally upended, right? But, so they're all connected.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think what you've got your finger on is exactly the point, right? Which is that the easier stories are also easier to land. So if you say things like leaders are out of touch, people go, yeah, leaders are out of touch, right? But I suppose the issue is that are they, or are there other factors at play here in terms of their ability to land their message and make their case?
Well, and I think you can differentiate in different walks of life, right? I think if you look at politics, I think there does have to be a reckoning in Western democracies, because if you look at the career paths of politicians today, so many of them are career politicians. And I'm not saying that makes them bad politicians, but the majority have kind of been in student politics and then gone on to be an advisor. And now,
so they're lacking vital experiences.
What I think is real world experience. But I also look at the other side of the coin. If you're someone who has built a career in the public sector or in business successfully, you know, why would you choose politics? And not even because it's not paid as well as many of those other professions. I think that's a factor in it. I think the fact we can't have a sensible conversation about MPs' pay is ridiculous. I think it's the same in many Western democracies. But
so many different ways we can take this interview now.
Well, I know. But more importantly, to your point earlier, like the absolute disillusionment with politicians, the belief. And again, I would say the majority of people that I meet believe that politicians are in it for themselves, that they're not there to serve society.
Well, a lot of people in business feel that, of course, is that, you know, a lot of people in business will put the same charge to political leaders as maybe
political
employees and actually
greedy
political leaders themselves. So in terms of this kind of, it feels like there's a lack of connectivity, a lack of mutual respect, a lack of potentially
also,
of understanding.
To
is
your
there?
Point about optimism, right? I don't. Life is really short, and I don't know how you can go through life being pessimistic and cynical about everyone and everything that's happening in the world. And look, there are institutions and infrastructures that were created hundreds or tens of hundreds of years ago that are essentially like broken and should be fixed. Fine, but people, humanity, I still believe the majority of people that I meet on any given day are good.
Yeah.
They want good things for themselves, their families, and for other people in society. And so unless we can break this cycle of cynicism that everyone's out for themselves and greedy.
I think you're right, because I think a lot about, you know, if you think about creation, if you think about, you know, new businesses, if you think about, you know, all of these things, is that they are all a process of positivity, you know, sometimes unreasonable positivity, but that's what gives you the stretch. It gives you the ambition to actually go for something.
100%. And I also believe there's enough room in this world for everyone to thrive.
Mm.
You know, you don't, it doesn't have to be at the expense of someone else, of another business. So, you know, I'm a big fan of like all ships rise together.
Yeah.
And so creating that camaraderie, that supportive nature, wishing like your competitors well, you know, because I think you look at industries that are thriving, it's because the majority of the firms in them are thriving, right?
And it's interesting when you talk about that idea about the ships rising, you know, I suppose that's because the tide rises with it. And of course, a lot of that tide is usually about growth. It's about it's about economic progress. And of course, we're living in a part of the world, in the UK and in Northern Europe, where actually growth eludes it. And I suppose in terms of how that environment changes, how that positivity exudes, there is a role for the communicator, because belief matters, right?
Yeah. And it's, to your point about simplicity earlier, it's so much easier to divide people. It's easy to create, you know, those you're that side, it's your fault that I'm not succeeding, right? Yeah. And that's what's happened so much in politics and in the media.
Mm.
And not like, creating an environment where, you know, you look at some local communities, you see them now and again in the national news, where everyone's coming together and supporting each other and thriving. They've got a thriving town centre and all the things that make a little community just beautiful. And it's because they believe in each other.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter where they've come from, what colour their skin is, what their accent's like. You know, they're all pulling together for the benefit of something that makes life better.
It's quite
better.
A nice analogy in the idea of a town centre, because, of course, town centres are where people
come
to meet. And actually, you know, quite a lot of the challenge of a more polemic-driven world is, of course, people don't meet in the middle. There's not a mutual respect. I guess that then brings on to our job, our role, you know, working as professional advisors, where the growth of resilience in corporations really matters, where actually trust is the currency which can be either the making or breaking of companies. How much better do we need to get as a sector to actually live up to the requirements of that role?
Well, I think there's two things for me. I think the first is, how curious are we about the world around us? Mm. And to your point earlier, you know, a good few years ago, God, it was probably in the Brexit debate, which I'm sure everyone can guess from what I've said so far, I was on there. But actually, it was a moment in time where I decided to start reading The Telegraph, right? So I was an avid, always read the FT, it was important for my job, but I was an avid Guardian reader, like very stereotypical in that regard. Although I did always read The Sun and The Daily Record as well. So
I'm just laughing,
you know,
the big reveal of our interview is Joanne Robinson reading The Daily Telegraph.
Yeah, but it was important, right? Because I really didn't understand. I didn't understand the venom with which people held in this debate. And I could see, agree, but I could see a point of view that was different to mine. I could understand why. I still read The Telegraph to this day. I very rarely agree with anything they write. But and it's just, it's one tiny example of, if you want to be a successful advisor, and you want to be trusted by the C-suite, they need to know that you're curious about the world. But you also have to have a confidence that you can give really good advice. Mm. And you can, it's not always, in fact, it probably rarely should be the advice they think they want and that they're going to get. And you have to have the skills, the human skills, and this is where I say AI is never going to take our job, to guide them through that process. But you also have to have the respect. And this is something I've I've had to come to terms with is it's also not my business. It's mm-hmm. their business. And I can give them the best advice to my ability and I can guide them to where I think they should go. But at the end of the day, if they make a decision to go in a different direction, it's my job to then make that the best possible
absolutely.
Outcome.
Yeah.
And I think the longevity of the client relationships I've had in my career are testament to my ability to do that and get them the best outcome,
yeah.
whether they take my advice or not. And they will always know I'll come at it with passion and energy and optimism.
That's probably what they want. They probably want the lens. They probably want the mirror.
Yeah.
But, see how it looks.
And then they know that whatever we decide, they will get the best execution of that decision. And I think we've got too many... I think calling them advisors is probably generous, but people in our industry who just tell clients what they want to hear
right.
for an easy life, to keep the bucks rolling in, you know, for fear of being fired or... But I think when you look at the best advisors across our industry and the ones that I really admire and who've had very long and illustrious careers with amazing longevity of client relationships, they're the ones yeah. who speak truth to your point.
They speak to truth. I think really good advisors also see things differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think that goes back to your point about curiosity in the world, which means that actually, if you're prepared to see life from a lot of different angles, I think your ability to advise is exponentially better because your job is to see all the angles, isn't it? And maybe spot the things somebody else hasn't actually
seen. I totally agree with that. There's one other thing I'd add to it though. And I think this is a superpower of the best advisors is using three words that say, I don't know.
Yeah,
because you can't possibly know everything. Mm. It's impossible about every issue, about every geography, about every, you know, decision that needs to be made, especially if you're working with the sort of clients we work with, big international, yeah. complex media businesses. And I've never been afraid to say, I don't know. Now, obviously, I follow up with, and I'm going to go educate myself and I'll come back with a point of view, right?
Well, and I suppose the thing is that as a business, we aspire to sit in quite a big seat, right? The first seat advisor is what we talk about. And that is a big step forward for people that may well have said, well, actually we do corporate comms or public affairs, or, you know, we do data. This is a seat that requires all of that, because it's the seat that is ultimately going to have one of the biggest and most influential impacts on the leader, on the CEO. In terms of how we as a sector start to see that, because I think, you know, we've both worked in the comm sector in an environment where I suppose we've been moving through those seats. Talk to us about the first seat advisor.
So for me, the strongest first seat advisor, we talked a lot about some of the characteristics already, but I think from an experience point of view, it's the people who have been curious and brave enough to really give themselves a diverse career. And you know, I've always completely disagreed with the whole idea that you need deep sector expertise in our business. Because as I've seen it over 20 odd years in this industry, the client always knows more about their sector than I ever have,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So energy and infrastructure, financial services, whatever it might be. Yes, I know a lot, but they live and breathe it from the minute they wake up till they go to sleep.
Right.
And the reason I've never gone in-house is because that's never been my desire. And so how I built my career was not to go down that route, worked in probably every sector there is, but actually to build expertise. So I started as a lobbyist, was very deep, actually loved that early part of my career. I then grew into issues and crisis, mostly political issues and crisis, but then from there, corporate issues and crisis, from there, corporate reputation. I then did CSR, ESG, for a while. And then when I made my move, so that was like my kind of Weber career, very corporate and public affairs heavy, but the entire expansive like world of that. And then I was really intentional about choosing Ketchum because it was a consumer brand agency. And I had no clue about the world of consumer,
yeah.
right? And actually, most of our clients obsess about their consumers all day, every day. And so I went there and I brought something heavy to them because they didn't really have a corporate and PA team at that time, very, very small. So I brought something valuable to them. But they taught me the world of consumer and really understanding consumer audiences mm-hmm. and how to bring consumers on a journey with
insights.
You. And so yeah. now I look 20 odd years later, I also did a lot of healthcare at Ketchum as well. Like, although that is an area where I do think you need the sector expertise to be a first chair advisor. but for me, like I can draw on all of that in any given moment or issue when I get a call from a CEO or a CCO or a CMO, whatever it might be. And also for each of them, less so the CEO, but if I'm talking to a CMO, I can come at it through the consumer lens,
right,
which
yeah.
is important for them.
And I suppose lots of different lenses lead to the advice. Now, listen, let's we're almost out of time. I want to come back to bravery. I've been looking through the LinkedIn family album. I'm seeing Glasgow Rangers, Arsenal, Sir Keir Starmer. I mean, there's a lot of brave decisions on those photos, Jo. What are we to make of the photo album in terms of what the world can expect from Joanne in this next chapter?
Well, look, a lot of optimism. I've definitely needed that with the Glasgow Rangers, Arsenal and the Labour Party. But yeah, a lot of optimism, a lot of bravery. I will be on that front line, locked in arms with you. But you know what? I think one of the things that really defines me as a friend, as a colleague, as an advisor, is loyalty. You know, I deeply, deeply, and I think that comes from growing up in a working class community. Like you have to be loyal to each other and help each other and support each other, because lots of people are going through tough times in working class communities then and now. So, you know, if you're in my orbit, loyalty kind of defines how I show up.
Right. Well, listen, Jo, thank you so much for joining me on
Changemakers.
Your first week as European president. I mean, it's been a big week for presidents around the world. I hope you enjoy your new role here at Bully Pulpit International BPI. Thank you,
Michael.